Today's Teisho will be on case 3 in the Wumenquan, the Mumonkan. Gute raises a finger. Whenever Gute Osho was asked about Zen, he simply raised his finger. Once a visitor asked Gute's boy attendant, "What does your master teach?" The boy too raised his finger. Hearing of this, Gute cut off the boy's finger with a knife. The boy, screaming with pain, began to run away. Gute called to him, and when he turned around, Gute raised his finger. The boy suddenly became enlightened. When Gute was about to pass away, he said to his assembled monks, "I obtained one finger Zen from Tenryu and used it all my life, but still did not exhaust it." When he had finished saying this, he entered into eternal nirvana. Mumon's comment: the enlightenment of Gute and of the boy does not depend on the finger. If you understand this, Tenryu, Gute, the boy, and you yourself are all run through with one skewer. Mumon's verse: Gute made a fool of old Tenryu, emancipating the boy with a single slice, just as Kyore cleaved Mount Kasan to let the Yellow River run through. Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen this morning. Yesterday morning I got up and I try to sit every morning, and I'm generally successful. So I got up yesterday morning and I did some meditation, some zazen. And I had the window open, and it was quite beautiful because where I live, there's a lot of trees. I'm very lucky to live in a place with a lot of trees. And outside the window, a mother woodpecker has made her nest. So all day long, she's letting out her sound. It's just every like minute. You know, it's like I can't duplicate that sound. It's so crazy, but it's a real shriek of life. You know, it's really beautiful. Maybe beautiful isn't quite the right word, but it every time I hear it, I feel happy. You know, and near my house too, there's also like birds, other birds. At night there's something called the screech owl. And the screech owl is a little tiny owl, and it makes a sound like at night. And it does apparently screech also, but this one doesn't screech much. You know, it just gives it. It's beautiful, right? And so sometimes when I get up early, if I start sitting around, say, 5 o'clock or even 4:30, I can still hear this owl, and it goes all night sometimes. It's really quite wonderful. And then as the sun comes up, the woodpecker gets going, and the owl becomes quiet. And sometimes there's crows in our backyard, also in the backyard. Long ago, we used to have sesshin, our retreats at my house. This was a long time ago. Jaru and Yen, of course, remember this. But this was quite a long time. Sometimes at sesshin we would have 5 people. So it's a very small group. And we would have it at my house. Sometimes when we were sitting, the Zendo was the living room. Sometimes when we were sitting, there would be a sound of crows, and the crows would be cawing at each other in the backyard, And sometimes they would be, crows have sort of this chortling. They go, So, yesterday morning when I was sitting, I could also hear a crow. It was, so it was beautiful, right? It was just one of those moments, when there's everything is, it's ordinarily, we have a kind of barrier between ourselves and the world. It's just there a lot of the time. It's a product of our, that barrier is a product of our mental habits, of our, the way we've constructed our consciousness. Very often we're walking around and, it's like there's it's like we're watching, like we're spectators. We're sort of like observing reality as though from a distance. This is a quite common feature of ordinary consciousness, you know. It's like we're walking around and we're watching things, but we're watching and things are happening around us, but we're not really part of it. You know, it's like we're not really part of it. There's a kind of an implicit separation between ourselves and everything else. But sometimes when we meditate, this goes away, you know, and you sit down on the cushion and you're watching your breath, and there's this wonderful state. I'm sure if you've been doing meditation for a while, you're familiar with it. You know, ordinarily, when we're walking around, we're looking at things. You look at and it's as though in front of your eyes, there's trees, there are cars, there's your breakfast. But behind your eyeballs, so to speak, there's like a screen, and there's like a movie playing on the screen, you know? So when we're looking at things, we're not just paying attention to the things in front of us. We're also like aware in some part of our awareness. We're cognizant of like things playing on the screen. And this, I think, creates that sense of separation from what we're seeing in front of us, you know. It can create, what's going on sort of behind our eyeballs, so to speak, really can color what's happening in front of our eyeballs, you know. A great example is the classic example is, you go to work and your boss gives you a hard time. Maybe you have a job where your boss is actually like you're afraid of him, or he yells at people or something like that. I myself, when I was in college, I had a summer job where my boss would just yell at me all day. It was really unpleasant, you know. I had to get a job to pay for my expenses in college, and I got my first summer job was a construction site in Reston, Virginia, and they were building this very large complex of houses there, and I was lucky enough to get a summer job, and I was making $2.50 an hour, $2.50, and in those days that would almost let me pay my in-state tuition at the university where I went, but I needed that money to go to college, and it was backbreaking work. I used to have to dig with a pick and a shovel all day, the boss was this guy who really resented me because I was going to college. He used to call me the college kid, and he'd say, "That college kid, you know, he can never do anything right." He always wanted to show that I was an idiot, right? Because he resented that I was going to college. He'd go, "You did that? Oh, that is so stupid. It's that college kid, you know." And he'd yell at me, you know. So, it made it unpleasant for me to go to work, right? And after a while, I just began to just thinking of work would create tension. Sometimes, I could be in the nicest spot, you know, I could be, in a nice place, but if I just thought of my boss, I would have tension, right? And so even if I were in a very pleasant place, I would have tension. And that's because behind my eyeball, so to speak, this tape loop is still playing. I remember going to visit my brother, and my dog was there. And the dog was barking, and I told my dog to shut up. I went, "Shut up!" And the poor dog, he was shocked, you know, because we had a pretty good relationship. And then I thought, why did I yell at Sergeant? That was his name, Sergeant. And I realized I really wasn't yelling at Sergeant. I was yelling at my boss, you know. But in other words, you know, that stuff is going on behind our eyeballs, so to speak. And it's greatly coloring how we experience the moment. This is a huge problem, you know. Over time, these kinds of, this like a process of projecting onto the moment, it becomes a huge problem. It becomes very difficult sometimes for us to interact in certain situations if we've had, if we have a lot of unpleasant memories or, if those movies are playing in our head, and it's very difficult to be in the present, you know. That's especially true with human relationships, you know. I had a relationship in college with a person named Tom Steptoe. And at first we were very good friends, and then we began to argue all the time about politics. For some reason, this was during the Vietnam War, my friend Tom took a turn to the right, and he became very pro-Richard Nixon. I couldn't understand it, you know, because I was very much against the war in Vietnam, and I thought Nixon was a true villain, like a Shakespearean bad guy, you know. And so Tom and I would have these long arguments, we would sometimes get very vehement. You know, young people can be very vehement. I was about 18, and I was passionate about my beliefs. And Tom became passionate about his beliefs, and he would listen to, there wasn't a Rush Limbaugh in those days, but there were people like Rush Limbaugh, and he would read these people and quote them to me. After a while, it was just impossible for me to talk to Tom because all of this stuff was playing in my head. I couldn't just be present with Tom, you know. There was all of this stuff in my head. It became impossible to have a relationship with him. So this is quite common. This can happen in romantic relationships too, you know. If you have a rocky time with somebody in a romantic relationship, after a while you just can't be, it's so hard, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but you just can't be present in the moment with them because there's so much baggage, there's so many things from the past. This is especially true, you know, for people who have been in relationships for a very long time. I myself have been married for 30 years. My wife and I both have to be very careful to try to be in the moment because we have a lot of movies. Some of them are pleasant and some of them are not so pleasant, you know. We can both remember times 20 years ago when each of us did something that wasn't so great, you know. So anyway, there's this problem, this big human problem of feeling separate from things, because there's like two screens, so to speak. There's the screen in front of us, which is what's actually happening, and then behind our eyes there's this other screen. And every once in a while, that stops. The screen behind your eyes just goes blank and dark, or blank and bright. And it's the most amazing thing. It's the most amazing thing, you know. It takes people a lot of meditation to enter that state. You know, when we sit down on the cushion and we try to watch our breath, often what happens is that the tapes start playing, you know. And they play, you know, and whatever happened to you today, it starts playing in your head, or you might have an inner dialogue and you're talking something through in your head. Or, you know, it could be literally like if you saw a movie, if you saw Avatar last night and you came to sit, you know, you can play the whole movie in your head while you're sitting there. And so a lot of meditation is learning how, it's either letting those tapes play until they run out, you know, or you just sit there long enough and the tapes stop playing, right? And during sesshin, especially, this happens, you know. So on the third day of a sesshin, it's very common for those tapes just to stop playing behind your eyes. It's like you get up one day and you sit down on the cushion and you're struggling to maintain your concentration. Maybe your legs are sore from doing so much meditation. And you might suddenly realize that there's nothing going on behind your eyes. You know, that screen is just blank and empty. And when this happens, it's really an amazing experience. And it, at first, perhaps it's very subtle for people, but when they begin to notice, you know, when the tapes are not playing behind your eyes, everything in front of you becomes extremely present, extremely richly present. There's nothing special about things in the sense that it's not as though they're, you know, they're glowing or they look bigger than they used to or something like that. But it's just that in their pure presentness, everything can seem very lively, very beautiful, and somehow intimate, you know, somehow connected. It can be, you know, quite ordinary things, but when you're in this state, you get this feeling of, you know, of, as I say, safety or connectedness or well-being, and everything can seem very precious for no particular reason. I remember many years ago, this was many years ago, maybe 14 years ago, 15 years ago, when we used to have sesshin at my house. At the end of the sesshin, everybody would go out the front door and I would say goodbye. And then people would get in their cars and drive down the street and go away. I had said goodbye to everybody. It was a summer sesshin, and Yen and Jaru were there, and Jim from our northern group, and I don't know if Imtiaz was there or not, but anyway, I said goodbye to everybody, and then I heard this sound, and it came and it went, you know, and it was so crisp, it was so beautiful. And the screen behind my eyes was not, there's nothing in it, you know. And the part of the brain, so to speak, that labels everything, this is that, this is such and such, this was quiet. And so I heard this sound, and it was just magical. It was magical. I'm not exaggerating. It's 16 years later, and I still, or 14 years later, and I still remember it. It was so beautiful and fresh and crisp. And I thought, what the hell is that sound? And I couldn't figure it out. And I walked to the side of the house and it was just a sprinkler. You know, my neighbor had the sprinkler on. It was one of these sprinklers that, it went in two directions. It went forward and then it went backward, you know, and there was a spray of water coming out of the little devices in the sprinkler, and it created a kind of wave, and the wave was hitting just like grass and ivy. But when my mind was in this state, it was just like it was the most beautiful music, and my mind was very bright, and I felt very at ease. You know, this state is highly valued. You know. In Zen, we put a lot of emphasis on what's called mushin, empty mind. And one way to understand Mushin, and this is just one way to understand Mushin, because Mushin is actually much more than this, but one way to understand Mushin is that it's describing the state in which the screen behind your eyes has become blank and dark, or blank and bright. In other words, you're not projecting onto the moment anything, any emotional coloring, no memories, and so on and so on. And in that, when you cease to color the moment with your memories or your projections and so on, it has this beautiful self-evidence, this beautiful presentness that's quite highly valued in Buddhism. Our word in Buddhism for this is tat-ata. That means like pure presentness, pure presentness. And, you know, all our lives we might be looking for something. You know, people go, you know, there's nothing wrong with going to Cancun or Hawaii. I've been to Hawaii myself. There's nothing wrong with going to Costa Rica or even Disneyland. But, the truth is that when we get there, it might not really be as fresh and exciting as we thought. You know, because you can be in Hawaii and you can be in great turmoil. And your mind can be caught up in these loops, you know, these obsessive loops. And the moment in front of you, you know it's just beautiful. You know, anybody who's been to like Waimea Canyon, it's beautiful. But you know, you can be in Waimea Canyon and be quite sad or quite distressed. And you know, we make an effort on vacation to be happy, right? But not sometimes we're not. You know, even if we try, or right under the surface there are these pressures. You know. And the interesting thing is that when we're really in the moment, when there's nothing going on behind our eyes, so to speak, and we're just present with what's here, you know, with what's in front of our eyes, it's so amazingly beautiful. It really is. It's just like going to Hawaii. And this is really hard to achieve. This takes many years. It can take many years, but when it happens, it's extraordinary. And I think it calls into question a lot of the way we live. You know, we, in our culture, we put so much emphasis on, like, fulfilling our dreams. And I understand it's important for people to have dreams. You know, it's important for people to have dreams. And it's wonderful when we can make it happen. You know, that's wonderful. So I'm not saying all dreams are out. You know, I'm not saying it's bad or evil to have aspirations for the future. But what I'm saying is that sometimes our culture is just like insane in its inability to enjoy what's present. You know, it's just absolutely so future directed. And so concerned with creating a new dream and then fulfilling it that we forget that sometimes just the most ordinary things can be quite extraordinary, really quite extraordinary. And our culture just doesn't teach us how to value that. You know, many years ago, I was training with a Kangan Web Roshi. And I had been sitting. This was when he and Genki Roshi were teaching together. But at that time, Webb really got interested in the Japanese tea ceremony. This was something he had not really been interested in all the time he was in Japan training. But when he came back, he got very interested in chado, in the way of tea. And he was trying to get people in our community interested in the tea ceremony, which is quite beautiful. But at the time, it absolutely left me cold. I couldn't understand why he was interested in this boring ceremony, where I could go through the whole thing, but it's an elaborate ceremony, and you have to put a certain kind of powdered tea in a bowl, and there's a certain way to do it, a correct way to do it. It's highly ritualized. And then you add water, and then you whisk it with a little whisk that looks like a bamboo shaving brush, you know. And then you drink it, and there's a way of cleaning the bowl, and so on and so on. And at the time, I just thought to myself, this is so excruciatingly boring. But years later, I began to realize this was very profound, that the teaching of, this teaching was very profound, that it was, you know, the man who started tea ceremony in Japan, one of the men, people who started, was a guy named Senno Rikyu. And, his idea was that not everybody can do zazen, but if he could make a simple exercise, like a simple practice, something people could do, anyone could do, they could learn how to value the still, quiet, empty mind and the experience of tat-ata. So if you do tea ceremony long enough, you stop thinking and you begin to enter this state of pure presentness. And then even the most simple things can become radiantly alive and beautiful. That experience is just so precious, in my opinion. You know, after people have their Daikensho, that self-evidence is very, very strong for a long time sometimes. And it's not always the case, but sometimes this is the case. And ordinary things can be very beautiful. Genki Roshi told me that he remembers eating breakfast with Soen Roshi. Soen Roshi was a Dharma brother of Genki Roshi. And they were both students of Yamamoto Genpo Roshi. At any rate, Genki Roshi was eating breakfast one day and he looked over and his Dharma brother, and they were just eating a bowl of white rice for breakfast, you know. That's what they would eat, white rice, miso soup, and some vegetables. And he looked over, and his Dharma brother's tears were just running down his face. And he was looking at the rice in his bowl. And I don't know if Genki Roshi understood at the time what was going on. You know, his brother wasn't having a psychotic breakdown. He was just experiencing very powerfully the tat-ata aspect of human existence. Very precious. It's really what Zazen, one of the things Zazen is all about, is just the world as it is quite extraordinary. Really precious. And we don't have to create Disneyland. You know, we don't have to do that to experience this extraordinarily powerful existence as it really is. We don't have to conquer the world or pollute the planet or so on and so on. We don't have to do that stuff. It's not actually necessary. What we're looking for is actually right here. The problem is the way we perceive. Yeah. That's like basic Buddhism. Buddhism is not about being like fatalistic. That's not fair. But there is something about the way modern people think, which is very, very impatient. You know, very impatient. And very, otherworldly. You know, modern people think that they're very realistic. Really practical, right? And this is the real world, Buster, right? And yet, you know, actually the world we live in is highly imaginary construction. Highly. You know, I was talking to somebody last night, who was telling me he had been a lawyer, a litigator for 25 years in Philadelphia. And he had patent. He couldn't go on. And so he quit, and he became a futures trader online. And apparently he hasn't made tons of money online. You know, he said he's lost some. I made some and lost some, he said. But he loves futures trading. He gets up early in the morning, he says, and he gave me some online sites, and he said this online site contains every English language radio station in the world. And he was so excited about it. And he told me, first of all, anybody who knows me knows I'm a computer moron, you know. So he was going into incredible detail about how to upload this and of course I just thought, you know, I really don't understand a word you're saying, you know, and I nodded like very sagely, like, oh, and that's a good strategy. You know? Oh, interesting. You know, I'll remember that, you know. And of course, I had already forgotten it, you know. But the thing is, he said he gets up in the morning and he starts futures trading, and he says he puts on his earphones, right, or his whatever, he's got an iPod, and he said he's got like 16,000 pieces of classical music on there, and he said I just tune out, and he said, and the hours just fly by, right? And he said, and that's what he does every day, right? And he said, sometimes I realize I have to mow the grass. Now, to each his own, right? To each his own. But I think that's escapism myself, you know? Now, there is an existential dimension to what he's doing. He's very engaged, right? But I think, personally, he's living in a very artificial world. You know, what could happen is this. You know, he gets up one day. Oh, he also has he buys his coffee from Dunkin' Donuts. He was telling me about that. So he has a Dunkin' Donuts coffee, a cup of mud, as he said. And then he goes and he sits down and he does the futures trading all day. And puts on the earphones and that's it. Here's what could happen though. He gets up one day and, okay, he makes his Dunkin' Donuts coffee. Then he goes and he goes up to his room and he sits down, but the electricity goes down, right? And so there's no screen, no futures trading, and there's no music, right? Let's say for some reason his iPod doesn't work. And it's like, now what, right? And so he could get up and he might have to go out into the backyard. And really, you know, for the hungry mind, the mind that's really hungry for stimulus, you know, this is like torture. My father was like this, you know. My father was, you know, he had to have like a stimulus for the screen behind his eyes, I guess. And if that wasn't being fed, he would get very nervous. He was a chain smoker and he would start drumming the table, you know, and this sort of thing. And I remember backpacking with my dad. My dad took me backpacking once because he thought it would be good for me to go backpacking. He became a scout master, and we went on a 50-mile hike. And I got very ill during the hike, and so I got left behind with my dad in one of the Appalachian Trail shelters. My dad had to take care of me, and he almost went crazy because there was nothing to watch, there was no TV, and so on and so on. He smoked all his cigarettes like in a couple hours, which made it worse. But that mind, the mind behind the eyes, craves stimulation. You know? And so, you know, for this guy, you know, that I'm talking about, he probably could have gone behind his house out into his backyard and just felt this insatiable hunger for stimulation. And the world might have been quite an unpleasant place to be. But, you know, we Zazen people, you know, we realize, you know, if you just sit there in the backyard long enough, you go through all these stages, right? You know, you're bored, then you're, you know, maybe angry, whatever. And then you begin to look around for something interesting, but there's nothing interesting. You know, it's just grass, it's just the sky, you know, it's just the wind, just birds. You watch and you watch, but if you do this for a long time, you know, you really can be changed. You begin to experience the richness of things just as they are. You know, it could happen to this person. It could happen. There's something distinctive about the modern world, though, where we just close ourselves off, right? Zen is about cultivating that state where outside and inside are the same. You know, so when the mind is blank behind your eyes, it becomes like an empty mirror. And what you see is really what you get, right? I mean, it's what you see is all there is in the universe, and it's absolutely wonderful. It's wonderful. It's like the mind becomes like a blank mirror, and everything around you is reflected in that empty mirror, and it's so richly alive. People have all kinds of ideas about enlightenment, but this is really one aspect of enlightenment. It's quite extraordinary. You realize this world is such a precious place to be. When Bhute holds up one finger, he's really saying inside and outside are the same. It's all one finger. Inside and outside are the same. And when we've achieved this state, everything is like heaven. Everything is holy. Everything is, perfect. Perfect. So Bhute's, trying to show people, telling people this doesn't do any good, but he's trying to show people, look at my finger. If you look at my finger long enough, you stop thinking, at first you think, what could it be? What's he trying to say? Finger. What could it mean? Finger. Hand. The hand. Homo sapiens have a finger, an opposable thumb, You could spend hours thinking this, right? This is what a lot of beginning meditation people do, right? They sit there and you think. Finally, eventually the screen goes blank. And you in little subtle ways, suddenly find yourself strangely happy, right? Strangely happy today. I'm strangely happy. I haven't gotten a raise. I haven't, but I'm strangely happy because my mind has become like a mirror. Humans have this beautiful capacity to imagine what is not the case. But it gets us into a lot of trouble. It creates extraordinary destructiveness and personal destructiveness too. And so, the one finger is like, my mind has become like empty, like a mirror, and so everything I experience is like perfect. And this is what he's trying to show rather than say with words. It's not easy to do, however, because we have this, this screen behind our eyes. And it's a complicated place. It's a complicated device. And it takes a lot of sitting to work through that part of ourselves, because it's like a, sometimes people talk, you could talk about it as it has a dimension which is unconscious, right? Unconscious. So often, the way we experience the world is unconsciously shaped by past experiences, and we don't even know it. But it's like those tapes are playing behind our eyes, and we often aren't even aware of them. Some of them are so old and so powerful, right? And they're playing all the time, I've talked about this before, but when I was very little, my parents lived in a place outside of Washington D.C. I think it was called Park Fairfax, Virginia, and it was a lovely little apartment complex. And then my parents moved to Baltimore, Maryland, because my father was working at a military installation near Baltimore. And suddenly, instead of living in this little protected apartment, I lived in a new set of apartments in a rather tough part of town. And I having to walk to school, I would almost be afraid of getting beaten up. And so for a long time, just going to school produced a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear. So this is part of, you know, all of us have all of these tapes in there. And so a lot of Zen meditation is learning, is working through those tapes. You know, you can become aware of them. And you can let them go. A lot of sitting practice is you sit down on the cushion and a teacher might give you a koan. And suddenly you become aware of something in the way you experience the moment that's blocking you. Or you suddenly realize you get angry a lot. Or you suddenly realize that you're very unhappy with the way you're living. You know, that can happen to people. You know, you start doing Zen thinking, I want to be calmer and I want to be more effective in my job. And then you start doing Zazen and one day you're sitting on the cushion and you realize, I really don't like my job. See, this is a very important dimension of Zen practice. You know, so often we don't want to, confront that aspect of things. You know, we don't want to face these this inner dimension. In Zen we talk about what we call true nature. True nature. See, we believe that there is a kind of an unconscious, right, which is actually fundamentally wise. Like fundamentally wise, fundamentally awake. Fundamentally, the mind behind your eyes is blank. But there are all these tapes and all these memories and all these images and pictures that are concealing like that fundamental blankness. And so, you know, a lot of meditation practice is working through all the junk. It's taking this screen off and this screen off and moving this aside and getting back to that essential blankness. And as you're going down, 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 and you're cleaning up, you know, you can discover things you don't necessarily want to see. So it's really quite possible people might start doing Zazen because they want to be more effective in their jobs. And then, you know, at some point in their Zazen practice, they suddenly realize they don't like their jobs. And then a real crisis can arise, right? Because you think, well, am I going to keep doing my job, or am I going to be true to what I've just discovered about myself, you know, which is that I don't like my job. I feel like a prisoner in my job, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a big part of Zen practice. A lot of times people get frozen because they can't accept what they're learning about themselves in the process of meditation itself, you know, can't accept it. If you don't work it through, you can't have that beautiful experience of oneness, right? You can't, because you're blocked. You know, you have to clean off the screen. You have to get back to the essentially empty nature of your mind. And so you have to remove whatever is in the way. I hope this isn't sounding totally crazy, but you know, you sit on the cushion and you want to be more effective in your job, and you think, meditation will help me. And then, you know, you keep sitting there and watching your breath, and you suddenly realize, my God, I hate my job, or I think I hate my job. You know, what people normally do when they have that kind of a recognition is they cover it up again. They go, well, that's no good. I can't deal with that. I have to like my job, you know, so they'll cover it up. But if you cover it up, you can't have that pure presence experience. You have to work through this. And so, you know, Zen practice isn't easy for all kinds of reasons. And one of them is that we don't necessarily want to clean up the screen because you have to go through all this junk that's in there. And that can be very challenging. You know, when you suddenly realize this is what I wanted to find, but this is what I found, that creates a kind of a crisis. And this is a big dimension of Zen practice, is is this facing these kinds of contradictions between what we think we should want and what our true nature is telling us is the case. So the mind is fundamentally empty, and when it's empty, it's happy and it's a very dynamic in its relationship to the world. But as we grow up, we have experiences that cause us a lot of pain, and also people are always telling us what should be real and what is, you know. So people are always saying, you know, I have a friend of mine I just wrote to yesterday on the internet, John Sunston, my old friend, who started training with me 34 years ago, when we were students of Genki Roshi. And we're still good friends. I wrote him yesterday. You know, John Sunston, his father was a very famous musical artist, like a composer and musician. And his father was a friend of the composer Sibelius. John Sunston is actually Finnish. His name is like a Norwegian name, but his family's really, they're Finns. And his father was a good friend of the famous Finnish composer Sibelius. And in Seattle, there's a lot of Scandinavians. And John's father had a school for music in Seattle, and was quite a distinguished person in town in the arts. And he wanted John to go into the arts, into music. And John wanted to go into science. And it created a huge inner conflict for John, because his parents, you know, oddly, John wanted to be a doctor, and his parents didn't want him to. You know, must be the only parents in the United States, you know, who didn't want their kid to be a doctor, right? And John wanted to be a brain scientist and doctor, which is what he became, and not a pianist and composer like his dad. So he had tremendous guilt about this, by the way, tremendous guilt. And felt he'd let his dad down, and so on and so on. These kinds of conflicts have to be worked through in order for us to have that beautiful experience of presentness. And Zen training, part of Zen training is, the koan training is actually seeing these conflicts and working through them. And a big obstacle is very often that we feel we should want to be a doctor. I mean, we should want to be a musician, right? But somehow some part of us wants to be a doctor. And that's what we call in Zen our true nature, true nature. And it can be from my own experience, you can be blocked for a long time in your life. You can be blocked for a lifetime even, where you just don't want to work through all that stuff. And you can have little moments of presentness, but you can't have like big moments of presentness, because you have to face something in yourself, some kind of a contradiction between what you think you should want and what you really want. And if you work that through, and you're true to your fundamentally empty nature, we call that being true to your true nature. True nature. Now, how do you know you're being true to your true nature? Well, generally speaking, you feel more alive. It might be painful and difficult to take away the fantasy, to get beyond the fantasy. But when you do, you feel more alive. There's more energy, and there's this sense of presentness and wholeness and connectedness. And so Zen is a process. It takes a long time. And you may have these experiences of connectedness and wholeness and so on. And then you have to go back and work through the junk behind your eyes. But sooner or later, the more you work it through, the deeper these experiences of connectedness become. And this is life. This is the life's work of the Zen person, of the woman of Zen or the man of Zen, is living this kind of life. And the mind can become like the blue sky. The mind behind your eyes can become empty, like the blue sky, if you keep removing obstacles eventually very, very blank, very, very empty, and very, very responsive to what's in front of your eyes. Very, very creative, very alive, very compassionate. So Gute, this is what Gute was trying to show people with his one finger. People would come to see Gute and they'd say, Gute, you know, I'm so depressed. I didn't get my raise this year. My boss wrote a bad report for me. And Gute would just stick up his finger. And he'd say, look, be in the moment. Be in the moment. And somebody would come to see Gute and say, Gute, you know, my ears are too big. You know, I can't, nobody will go on a date with me because my ears, one finger. So he'd say, Gute, you know, I've written this novel, but I want it to be the greatest novel. I want it to be the greatest novelist in Chinese history, but it's no good, right? What'll I do? Gute would just stick up his finger. And so this is like, this is the goal, right? You come back, back to the moment, back to what's actually the case, and you work through your obstacles, And this process, there's two dimensions of practice, being here, and working through the tapes, working through the illusions behind our eyes. And eventually the mind becomes like a mirror and the world becomes so alive. Now, in the story, Gute would hold up his finger and everybody would be better. They'd go, my God, you're right. I see now. It's just a fantasy that I'm going to be the greatest novelist in China. I don't have to be the greatest novelist. The moment's quite beautiful as it is, Thank you. And somebody else would come and say, I can have big ears. I'm okay. The moment's beautiful. It's a wonderful place to be. And so on. So people would be healed by Gute's method, And their minds would become blank behind their eyes and the world would become alive. But Gute had an inji-san. He had an attendant who would see him doing this, and he'd escort people out of the temple after they met with the Roshi, and people would say, oh, Gute is so enlightened. I feel better already. And the little monk would think, oh, I'd love people to say that about me. So he'd go into the village to do errands for his teacher, and people would say, how were the grapes? Did you give the grapes to your teacher? How were they? And the kid would hold up his finger and they'd go, oh, what a wise little kid! But it was all BS, right? And so Gute heard about this. Somebody came to see him and said, boy, not only are you wise, but your attendant is wise. He too uses one finger Zen. So Gute said, hey, attendant, come in here for a minute. And in his sleeve, he had a knife, right? Don't do this at home. And he would say, listen, attendant, I have a question for you. Is Buddha nature one or is it two? And the kid held out his finger and Gute chopped it off. Right? And the kid looks at the stump, right? And he has a Daikensho experience, great awakening experience. So this is meant to say, at that moment, his inside and outside were unified. The inside became blank, and the pure presence of the moment, though he's staring at his stump of a finger, was fundamentally enlightening. So you don't have to cut off your finger to practice Zen. But it does take a little bit of work and courage. But the result is really quite marvelous, I would say. Whenever Gute Osho was asked about Zen, he simply raised his finger. Once a visitor asked Gute's boy attendant, what does your master teach? The boy, too, raised his finger. Hearing this, Gute cut off the boy's finger with a knife. The boy, screaming with pain, began to run away. Gute called to him, and when he turned around, Gute raised his finger. The boy became enlightened. Mumon's verse, Gute made a fool of old Tenryu, emancipating the boy with a single slice, just as Kyore cleaved Mount Kasan to let the river the Yellow River run through. So, you know, what we have to get rid of is our illusions, right? That can be a little bit difficult, but when we get rid of them, everything becomes quite beautiful. And so today, you know, people came here to practice Zen. We sat on the cushion and did this crucial work. And I hope you had some moments where that beautiful tat atta was present for you. And I really very much hope we will do this again soon.